Species unite.
When we do polls on this, we've got all political parties, high support for ending cosmetics animal testing from Republicans, independents, Democrats, age gaps between the boomers and the zoomers. Everybody's in agreement. You know, it's one of those issues that you cannot get more unity on a single issue.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We'd like to thank Lush for sponsoring today's episode. Lush advocates for people, animals, and the planet. Through their ethically sourced ingredients and their grants program, they give back locally and around the world. This conversation is with Monica Ingbritsen. Monica is the North American Head of Public Affairs for Cruelty Free International. Cruelty Free International is the leading organization working to end animal testing worldwide. And they're working to end all animal testing. But for today, we focused on cosmetics. Hi, Monica. Thank you so much for doing this today. It's really great to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I know you've been working in animal protection for a very long time, and Cruelty Free International has been around for a very, very long time. You are the organization that focuses on all testing, you know, and experimentation on animals in labs for everything, medical reasons and cosmetics and everything else. But I would love to talk about cosmetic testing for two reasons. One is because we haven't before on this show. I don't know why, but we've talked a lot about medical testing, but not about cosmetics. And the other reason is because I've talked to so many people who just assume we don't test on animals for cosmetics anymore. I think it's really important that people are still aware that we're not quite there yet.
I can understand the confusion. There's been a lot of change since the 80s, for example, and then even in the past 5 years in the explosion of alternatives that are available for testing cosmetics, and then also the reasons that animals might still be tested for cosmetics has changed. It's not so much the companies aren't driving it, it's regulators demanding these tests. And then now companies are on the same side oftentimes with animal advocates, where we used to be at odds with each other. We're now actually more often on the same side with companies asking regulators not to require these tests anymore. So both sides are right that there's been a lot of change, but there's confusion over where we are right now in cosmetics and animal testing.
A lot of different aspects of it are kind of confusing, and I want to kind of take them apart.
Sure.
Starting with, when you say cosmetics, it's a lot more than makeup and beauty products.
Yeah, it's mostly cosmetics and beauty products, but it's also shampoos and deodorants, where it's a little confusing. It's that there are ingredients that kind of cross over. So some things like a sunscreen or an anti-dandruff shampoo is a cosmetic, but it contains a drug ingredient. So some cosmetics contain drug ingredients, and that's where the conflict with the animal testing also comes back into play, because if it's a drug and it's new, it needs to be tested on animals. But if it's in a cosmetic, people assume it's a cosmetic. And so that's where the lines get crossed on what is a pure cosmetic ingredient and what is not. And that's where a lot of the conflict arises in this space.
What animals are we testing on for cosmetics?
Historically, it has been rats, mice, guinea pigs, and rabbits.
I would imagine people who are developing new products now would try to be cruelty-free, right?
Yeah.
Is that true? Is it like the older school products that are still testing and not so much things that have come around in the past 5 years?
Both things are kind of true. Now, typically with a ban, or when we talk about stopping animal testing, we're always talking about new animal testing. We can't go back and unring the bell of, you know, that animal testing existed in the past. So that data, that animal testing data still exists, and it's out there. It's in circulation on ingredients that we've been using for a long time. So if a company uses that animal testing data that's been in existence for a long time, that's not really considered for new cruelty-free products a breach of a cruelty-free policy because the data was out there. We're talking about new animal testing, which usually takes place in the development of a brand new ingredient. That's where the animal testing might come into play, is in a new innovative ingredient. But most cosmetics are just recycling the same ingredients over that have long histories of safe use and can be done and, you know, used safely and have data, both animal and non-animal possibly. And so that's the case. And then, so that's kind of, it's a little bit of both. But yeah, most companies, they now know not only is it easy to be cruelty-free because of all the alternatives that are now available, which are a lot of those companies, they're the ones that invested in creating those. So you have to give them credit, but they knew the writing was on the wall, the customers did not want this. And it's still one of the most important issues to consumers.
What stops a cosmetics company from being cruelty-free? Like, why wouldn't they?
In some cases, if they maybe just haven't gone through the process of going through an approval program, such as the Cruelty-Free International Leaping Bunny program or other programs that are out there, they haven't gone through the process, which requires a kind of a deep dive in looking at their supplier line, where all their ingredients, because not all of them do their own testing. They contract that out or get ingredients from other suppliers and making sure that animal testing isn't part of that chain, and being open to opening their books and looking at where all the ingredients are coming from. So some maybe just haven't taken the time. Others get into trouble when it comes to their importing products to another country where animal testing might be required, or there are certain ingredients that, it sounds funny to say, but oftentimes an ingredient that is used in a cosmetic is also used in a non-cosmetic product. And there might be different testing requirements when that very same ingredient is used in a different product. And so that interplay between what we call a dual use ingredient or foreign testing requirements becomes problematic. And that's where you see the conflict.
When you're talking about foreign testing, for example, China.
Yes.
In China, products have to be tested on. Is that still true?
It is not still true. It is changing. So the answer is it depends and it's a moving target, but things are getting better. So historically, yes, China, for any imported cosmetic, which most cosmetic companies were importing, not creating them there, they were requiring the animal test. They've started to loosen that. And in some cases with imported cosmetics, a company can't enter the Chinese market with assurances that they will not be asked to produce the animal testing data. And China is asking them to produce a certificate, what we call a good manufacturing certificate. The problem is most countries don't actually issue those. So companies are working now to get their countries to issue the certificate that the Chinese authorities are wanting. So it's tricky and complicated, but the good news, the upshot is things are changing and there are pathways for cruelty-free cosmetics to get into China. And there's a Chinese market that also wants cruelty-free cosmetics.
Monica, I'm a little bit confused.
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay, let's look at it this way. So this year, I live in New York, and New York passed the cruelty-free cosmetics law.
It means new animal-tested cosmetics, a cosmetic that contains an ingredient that uses new animal testing data to substantiate the safety would not be able to be sold in New York.
But can companies that sell in countries that require testing sell in New York?
They can. But what they would not be able to do is turn around if they tested an ingredient for the Chinese market and they say, well, now I have this animal testing data. Why don't I just use it to sell the product in New York? I already did the animal test. They can't turn around and use that animal testing data. They would have to prove the safety of that ingredient without the use of animals, still, they wouldn't be able to rely on that animal testing data. So it can't be used as a loophole. And obviously, we wanted stronger laws. We all want that. But when you're dealing with state level, states really cannot dictate foreign policy. So it's outside of the purview of what was possible. But we did make sure that they can't use it as a gaping loophole to just come back and go, well, we had to test for China, so here you go.
Let's talk about Leaping Bunny. Cruelty Free International, you guys are Leaping Bunny.
Right. We run the program. It gets a little complicated too there. We run the program internationally. And if a company wants to be approved that's based in Canada or the United States, then they would just go through the CCIC, the Consumer Information on Cosmetics, which run their own program that's similar, but it's a different approval process. But in general, it's an approval process like what we talked about before, going through a process of looking at your supply line and making sure that animal testing isn't happening in your current supply line.
So anything with the leaping bunny on it.
Yeah, and that would go above and beyond what the law requires. So a company that was testing their products to sell in China wouldn't be able to have that certification. So the certifications are still, or the approvals are still important for consumers that want to know that their companies are really taking it seriously and making it a priority.
In the United States, we have 9 states that don't... Ten. Wow.
Yeah. What was the New York latest? Was the 10th.
Oh, that's the 10th. Okay. Yeah. What does it take to get a federal law that we stop doing this? Because we really don't need to be at this point, right?
Yeah. That's the frustrating thing is obviously a federal law is what we all want. It harmonizes, you know, state legislation and is more enforceable. There's only so much enforcement that can go on a state-by-state basis. And certain things have to be under the purview of the FDA. The states just can't do it. So at this point, the states have done what they can do. We need the federal law to harmonize things and to help ensure that regulators aren't demanding animal tests for cosmetics when it's not necessary. We still are at risk of that. The problem is they just passed the MOCRA, the Cosmetics Modernization Act, which would have been that updated FDA's authority over certain aspects of cosmetics. That was the golden opportunity to stick the Humane Cosmetics Act in there, at least something similar, at least what the states have done. They could have stuck that right in there. That was the time to do it, and they refused to do it. So that was very frustrating that you're going to update U.S. cosmetics policy, and you're going to leave out the issue that is the most important to consumers. And yet they did it. So I cannot say that I am very disappointed that it happened, but we just have to keep trying. And obviously the states have led the way. And now we have Canada has surpassed us in just passing their regulation. And we have the support of most of the cosmetics industry. So there really is no reason not to do this. And it is really frustrating that we missed that opportunity.
Why would they do that? What's in it for them to not pass it?
Yeah, I don't know. The legislators... The Humane Cosmetics Act has lots of support on the Senate and in the House side. It has support from the industry. It has support from advocates, consumers. Just a complete blind spot or resistance from wanting to address it, I really can't say because it seems so silly that we wouldn't have put something in there. It just doesn't make any sense. So I can't defend the reasons they didn't do it, except that they did not.
It's just shameful. And Canada did it. Come on.
I know,
right?
I know.
And so Canada, the whole country, there's no more cosmetics testing as of this year.
It can't happen. The act of cosmetics testing, so the animal tests for cosmetics can't take place in Canada. And then they prohibited the sale of cosmetics that rely on new animal testing data.
But not us. We have alternatives, right? Will you talk about some of the alternatives?
People want cosmetics to be cruelty-free, but they want them to be safe. And the thing is, with animal tests, animal safety tests, when people think about what those are, kind of the traditional tests going back 70 years are the kind of horrific tests where the first tests created were the ones like dropping a chemical into a restrained rabbit's eye to see what impact a cosmetic would have on their eye, or shaving a guinea pig or rabbit skin and putting the ingredient on the skin to see what the reaction was. Those are some that people can really visualize. And 70 years ago, that's all they had, but those tests were never very good. The animal tests have never been very good at predicting human response. It's just what they had at the time. So since then, we've developed alternatives that do not require animals, and those tests are actually more accurate. So not only, than the animal test, they're more predictive of a human response than an animal's response. Animal response might over-predict the reaction that a human would have or under-predict. So you need it to be accuracy. And then over time, because more companies started investing in it and using these alternatives, the demand was there. They are now cheaper and they're faster. You can produce the results of a test in a week, what used to take, or even a few days, what used to take a lot longer with the animal test, depending on what kind of endpoint you were looking at.
What are the tests that they're doing? Like, what are the actual alternatives?
An example of an alternative for the skin sensitization or skin irritation would be human skin cells that are grown in a laboratory dish. So you're actually testing it on human skin, or even computer simulations. Now, the process of an allergic reaction is a chemical reaction that can be simulated in a computer, or eyes, some alternatives to the eye. There's a reconstituted human cornea, or prior to that, it was still using an animal, but it was using eyes from chickens or cows that had been slaughtered. So at least it was a dead animal. That was kind of the first step. But even more and more, they're moving on to alternatives that don't rely on any kind of animal material, even if it's a dead animal, but using completely modern human-based science.
It's also just more absurd that we're still testing when even the industry wants to not be testing.
Yeah, and that's where we've seen this change. Even in the last 5 years, like when I first started working, in some cases, we were still kind of fighting with some of the industry associations over this. But when we really got together in a room, we could decide that, you know, we weren't really that far off in what we wanted. And what some of the problem was is that, you know, having regulators asking for animal testing data that really isn't necessary. And we agreed in, but obviously we're from an animal rights perspective, you'd be like, well, if you're asking for an animal test, then just don't do it. Don't use that ingredient. From an industry perspective, that's a lot of money to give up. So the common ground is they really shouldn't need these animal tests. We don't need them. We have the innovation. Don't ask for it. So nobody has to give up. You can have your new ingredients and you don't, you know, and you can save animals. That why don't we, you know, we should be on the same side on this. And now largely we are.
I read recently that 46% of Gen Z will not buy a product that's been tested on an animal. We're getting to a point where consumers aren't going to buy products that are tested. And also, it feels like, tell me if I'm wrong, but it feels like if we can get animal testing out of cosmetics, like that's the first really big hurdle to getting it out of everything.
Yeah. And cosmetics, it should be easier because like we've talked about before, that the amount of the ingredient that's being used is smaller. So because it's used in a cosmetic, sometimes certain tests aren't required. And if you go larger amounts, then a certain test might be required. But cosmetics, it's such a small, minuscule amount that you don't reach what's called the threshold of toxicological concern. And so it should be the easiest place to finally root out animal testing and then move on. And it actually kind of has worked that way because a lot of the investment that went into finding alternatives to animal testing for cosmetics, those same alternatives are now being used in other spaces. So there's been this knockoff effect where even being used in pharmaceutical testing and, you know, that human relevance aspect of the tests that were developed because of cosmetics, that's where the money got put behind it because it was the cosmetics company that had the money to invest. And now those tests are out there and actually have helped in so many other sectors. You know, so it's all connected, obviously. But we try to parse it out and say, you know, at least cosmetics, we should be able to draw the line here. But as you've heard this, it's not that easy. It's not that
No, simple. It's not. It's mind-blowing that we're still here. I mean, the one place we're really not still here is that the general public doesn't want these products.
Yeah.
You know, and people really care about animals in a different way, I think. There's just a lot more awareness and a lot more concern.
Yeah. It is this issue where I don't think, and I've said this before, I don't think you could maybe find any other issue where you get such alignment. When we do polls on this, we've got all political parties, high support for ending cosmetics animal testing from Republicans, Independents, Democrats, age gaps between the boomers and the zoomers, everybody's in agreement. You know, it's one of those issues that you cannot get more unity on a single issue. And it was the same in Canada, the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party. People that identified in one of those camps and the generations, there was broad agreement.
Were you surprised, though, that it passed? Like, it was a big deal when it passed in Canada.
Yeah, well, we had been working for 5 years really closely with the Health Canada and with industry there. So it was another collaborative effort getting, you know, industry on side. And that's why I think the tipping point for the Health Canada was that we did have the industry on the same side. We'd already gotten together and worked out the details on what we could live with, what we could agree on, and that made it easy. And then they knew that they had the consumer report. We had taken, you know, millions of signatures up to the parliament. It was the biggest petition that they had had since the Canadian Bill of Rights, you know, when we took that up there. So it was a win-win for all the parties. They just had to get it right. And so the fact to get it into a government bill, which is what happened, we knew we had it done. We didn't want to celebrate yet because crazy things happen, until it was done. But yes, it was definitely a huge achievement. And it's nice that we can now point to Canada and say, US, can we at least do what Canada's done?
You know? And so for a couple of acts that you guys are trying to pass in the US, one is called the Hearts Act.
Yeah.
Will you talk about that?
The Hearts Act deals with what we talked about, the other side of animal testing, more of the medical and basic research side. So the Hearts Act deals with animal research and experimentation that is funded by the National Institutes of Health. And that National Institutes of Health is the biggest funder of animal experiments in the United States and probably the world. And so what that bill does is it's a bill to help reform how grant money is sent out for experiments to ensure that alternatives to the use of animals in this research is prioritized, that researchers are incentivized to use the alternatives so they don't just take a checkbox approach and use animals in research and testing in that space. And it also sets up a funding mechanisms to increase the amount of funding that's available for further development of alternatives in science in that space.
And what's the CARE Act?
So the CARE Act is the Companion Animal Release from Experiments Act, and that would be a national law also directed at the NIH, but it would say that any laboratory that takes money from the NIH, which is taxpayer money, has to have an adoption policy in place for dogs, cats, and rabbits that are no longer wanted for research, healthy adoptable animals. They should not just be killed. They should be offered for adoption. Several states have done this with cats and dogs, but we need a national law so that all states have to do it. And usually it's about taxpayer-funded place, which is all the universities. Most places, many laboratories get money from the NIH. So, but that's the taxpayer link, that if you're taking taxpayer money, then we have a right to dictate what happens, what you do. You know, that's kind of that pathway that you do have a say over what happens. And that's why we kind of target that, is to say that there is a responsibility when you're taking taxpayer money, although we would rather animals not be experimented on until we get to that point. We want to know that if animals survive an experiment or are no longer needed for whatever reason, they're not just being killed, they're having an opportunity to be adopted into homes.
Which this one also you would think would be like, why wouldn't everyone be doing that? What would be the resistance be on that?
So the resistance would be, well, there's always an element of don't tell us what we can and can't do, you know, in states where they universities want to take our money, but don't want to be told, you know, what they can and can't do. Some will complain about the cost, but in surveys that we've done with universities that have adopted animals, they never identify any costs. So that's really not a problem. It's just, you know, making sure that they do it and that it becomes a priority. It's always going to be easier just to kill animals than to evaluate them for adoption and to work with, you know, rescue groups. You know, so there's a couple of schools of thought. I think sometimes they don't want to adopt out animals because it does remind the public that animal experiments are happening, and they don't like to remind the public that dogs, cats, and rabbits, you know, when you release them from a laboratory, everybody remembers, oh yeah, this is happening. At the same time, for those who work in laboratories, those that still, you know, care about animals or, you know, in the university, it's a good thing for them to be able to say that the animals, you know, were able to leave and not, you know, go on to live. I imagine that there are some technicians and people that work in laboratories, you know, all judgments off, but that they do actually feel bad that the animals are killed or what happens to the animals.
Even researchers, right? Yeah. I mean, that have a moment of like, oh no, what have I been doing for 20 years?
They're conflicted themselves.
Everyone should buy products only that have the Leaping Bunny on them, you know, cruelty-free products, going back to cosmetics.
Yeah, yeah.
But what else can people do to make this happen faster?
Yeah, so laws take a long time, but that is the way that things happen. It's one of the more concrete things that people can do, other than, like you said, using their consumer power or, you know, volunteering for a group that's, you know, foster an animal that's come out of a lab. There's rescue groups that take in animals. They always need foster. Of course, adopt one if you can, but if you can foster, that's part of the process too. So there's that hands-on aspect of it. I fostered and then adopted a rabbit that came out of a lab. It was really rewarding to have that hands-on experience. And then following our website so that you can write to your legislator asking them to co-sponsor the Hearts Act or the CARE Act or the Humane Cosmetics Act, because hearing from their constituents, it is really important. And in the form letters, great, but also a phone call, and it doesn't have to be daunting. It'll be somebody in the office will answer the phone and you'll say you're a constituent. They might ask you where, and then you tell them the bills you want them to support. Because while most people don't reach out to the legislators. So the office knows that for every one person that reaches out to tell them what is important to them, they know there's at least 10 more people that feel the same way, but just didn't bother to call. So your call and your outreach to your U.S. senator or representative is very impactful.
We did a show about that, I think like a year or so ago, and we had five different people from five different states who were working on laws, and every single one of them was like, people don't really believe anymore that your letters and your phone calls make a difference. It seems so old school or something, but every one of them was like, it is massively important that you make these phone calls and you send these letters, send these emails, because they do, they hear them, they see them.
Yeah.
And they do make a difference because other people aren't doing it. I didn't know that until then, like how important that was.
It's easy to get jaded because you see so many. And granted, there are a lot of petitions out there for various things that aren't well thought through petitions. That's probably the least effective thing, unless it's part of something that's a very well-directed petition. And then, so that's like the lowest form. But still, you know, if it's a good, well put together petition, then do it. And then it's the Insta letter that, you know, people want that. That's art. You don't have to think about what to say. You can add a few, even just adding a few words of your own at the top is really helpful. And then the most impactful thing is probably still the phone call or the handwritten letter, but the phone call is easy. It feels uncomfortable at first, but it's something that people don't do. And it can only take, you know, might only take a few minutes, but it's because most people don't do it that it sort of increases that impactfulness.
Awesome. That's good to know. And I good to encourage people to do it too, because we need this stuff to happen quicker. Monica, thank you. Thank you for everything you're doing, and thank you for today.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
To learn more about Monica and to learn more about Cruelty Free International, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. If you have a spare moment and could do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. If you would like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. Go to our website, speciesunite.com, and click donate. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, Ayana Peoples, Olivia Deming, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.